Well, thank you everyone for coming. It's a pleasure to be here, seeing some familiar faces. So I will describe you a rather simple idea and in our initial experiments on doing quantum simulations of really many body phenomena using superconducting circuits. And so the basic idea here is that, I will mostly try to explain how by making a rather special transmission line, which just carries electrical signals with some properly chosen parameters, can actually get you to simulate rather exotic models. So in our field of superconducting quantum computing, there have been a lot of progress that's usually summarized by this plot where you show sort of the coherence times and operation per error of superconducting circuits as a function of time, in years. And here is, time is in nanoseconds, and you see it's a log plot, and, it seems to kind of grow exponentially. Which is really remarkable on the one hand, and on the other hand, it kind of creates all this excitement, and more and more ideas are coming up of what else can you do with the circuits. So quantum simulations is one of them. So this plot is probably out of date by now, but anyway, it's just a general picture. So we keep coming up with new circuits that could do more and more interesting things, and their coherence grows, and that's really what enables us to, to keep coming up with new stuff. But the amazing thing is that if you just examine what you have at the elementary level, you only have three elements, and you play some sort of a Lego game, where you take some very simple looking elements, and you build something fancy. So in our case, it would be a capacitor, and it's just something that, its energy is quadratic with charge, and an inductor whose energy is quadratic with flux. And there's this magic element, a Josephson junction, whose energy depends on a superconducting phase difference, but phase difference to a Josephson junction is exactly the same thing as flux to an inductor, because the time derivative of flux is voltage, and time derivative of phase is also voltage. So you can think of this junction as a nonlinear inductor. A very special one, and that's it. That's really it. That these are all the circuit elements we have, and we don't allow resistors, which is probably by far the most common circuit element when you go to a radio shop. And when you do that, you get this. You get quantum mechanics in, so this flux and charge begin to behave kind of like position and momentum, and they commute in fact in exactly the same way. And that's essentially our quantum Lego set. And now you can ask yourself questions, okay, how can you simulate now a Hamiltonian that you like? Well, you can go next step, and you can, so we can review various common circuits that you can build out of these three elements. So we can create artificial photons just by connecting capacitor to inductor. You're going to get a resonator, and so it will resonate at some frequency omega r, and so you'll get photons. And in fact, you have two options to connect L and C. You can connect in parallel and in series. So circuit specific details. We can also make spins. So here we're going to need a junction to create some nonlinearity, and in the end, at low energies, the system can have only two states. So it will be your spin, and you can connect spins to photons using this concept of circuit quantum electrodynamics. So this is a circuit that simulates a photon. This is a circuit that simulates a spin, and you can couple them so that you'll get this very, very simple sort of photon to spin coupling. What's more is that we can create couplings of pretty much arbitrary strength. So that's just an example of a typical experiment where a spin, which is a straight line, is interacting with a photon, which is the horizontal line. So this is some control parameter that sweeps the frequency of the spin to cross the resonator. There's these anti-crossings. The meaning of this anti-crossing is this G constant in the interaction Hamiltonian, and it can be big, and it can be pretty much engineered the way you like. With this tool set in mind, you can ask a question. Okay, so can we simulate something more exotic than just a spin or a photon or their coupling? You have two options to proceed. So you can do digital quantum simulations. So there you're going to need pretty much a working quantum computer, maybe a small scale one, and by doing some highly controlled operations, you can emulate the dynamics of the Hamiltonian that you like. Or you can go analog, and you can just construct a circuit whose Hamiltonian implements dynamics that you like just directly in real time. So in principle, I think it's a common belief that digital is better than analog, at least in the classical world. But this has not been always like this. Everything started analog, and then when digital becomes becomes very robust and good, then you do everything digitally. And so since we don't really have a well working quantum computer, you might get a lot more results out of this analog approach. And so that's really what I'm going to describe today. So these are the two, two maybe most commonly talked about examples of what you can do with circuits when it comes to simulating many-body physics. So you say, well, you can simulate sort of a photon. You can couple a qubit to it, so you're going to get a nonlinear photon. So and then if you couple a lot of these systems together, you might build some kind of a network of sites, which where photons can hop and interact. So kind of looks like a Bose-Hubbard model. The other system that people usually talk about is just a model of interacting spins. So again, since you know how to make one spin, and you know how to make two spins interact, you might as well create some kind of a network of these spins that are interconnected in some right way, and you can get pretty complicated spin models. So it all sounds good, but the main problem is that usually there is just too much disorder. All these circuits are not exactly the same. They're not like rubidium atoms, which are really made to be identical. So these are just kind of human-made objects, and there's some disorder. And controlling individual constituent of this circuit to kill this disorder is usually impractical. And so as a result, there are, to my knowledge, not really any really working experiments where this thing works. And so we've been thinking of other systems, other interesting phenomena, where maybe you can, yeah, go ahead.
So what kind of disorder would you like to have? 1%, 0.1%, 10%?
Well, you need to actually go to below. Well, it depends on the proposal. The problem is that there's not a universal number which helps you. It depends on particular device. For instance, in this network of cavities, you see it's hard to engineer coupling, for instance, a lot bigger than a few megahertz. And so then if your frequencies, which are typically gigahertz, has a spread of a few megahertz, you're screwed. And usually it's hard. So for that's, for instance, handicap here.
Sorry, I have a little question about this. Can't you just build your system in such a way that all of these components you create and engineer, and then you put them all together?
What you do.
But then the disorder, is it such a serious limitation?
Yes. So a lot of people, a lot of theorists ask me, but you guys have these awesome superconducting qubits, they work so well. Yes, they do, but they're different. These are not rubidium atoms which are the same by design, by nature. So the transition frequencies of these circuits are not fundamental constants. They are whatever you've put into your fabrication. And in fact, it might be relatively easy to make two devices identical, but if you have, a 10, it becomes harder. If you have 100, it's even harder. So that's really the problem. So the circuits are not identical by this by design, like atoms. There is disorder, and it happens to be, to be.
And you cannot realize them separately and then patch them together.
No, that's what you do, right?
Okay, but then
you fabricate them one by one. No,
they're not all the same.
It is not the same.
Yeah, sure, but you can get the transition frequency. I mean, with
these. It's like two babies, right? I mean, they're never. There's always some difference.
No, but you can preset. I mean, I agree with you that if you want to create 100 all at the same time, then you cannot overcome that. But if you can realize, okay, first, I mean, a row.
Maybe you can teach me also to talk, because I'm out of clue.
So, but don't the D-Wave people claim when they actually do that? So that they build, like,
it's an example.
Yes. The D-Wave, right? Yeah.
So in D-Wave, they take the strategy of individually tuning every single object. That's a potential, a possibility, but the wave at the same time limits itself to sort of a limited set of problems. I'm not really in a position to comment how well it works.
So the reason that's really claimed that they
Yeah, well, I think all that I'm trying to say is that these proposals are pretty old, and if you ask why it's not working, I mean, the answer is that, well, there's just too much disorder. So maybe if everyone works on making this disorder smaller, it will of course work.
But there are some questions where disorder is not necessarily a bad thing. So this is all focused on quantum computing, right? So this proposal is topologically topologically ordered state, right?
Yeah, I just took it as an example of implementing a Hamiltonian with a pretty unusual properties.
But for example, do people talk about localization phenomena or Bose glasses or something? There are lots of questions where disorder is just a good thing.
And I'm going to talk about one of those.
Okay, I see.
Yes.
As I understand, this disorder or individual elements being different was a problem in digital electronics too. And then some advanced manufacturing techniques like layer by layer deposition or etching on a single wafer of semiconductor mitigated or completely eliminated them. Do you see adoption of such a different manufacturing technology eliminating this problem?
In the long term, yes. So, but not tomorrow, not today. So in the long term, of course, fabrication will get better, and so disorder will get better as well. But my point of bringing this up is that look, you can focus on problems that actually are kind of insensitive to this stuff. And so this is really the purpose of my talk is to give you an example of a problem which can be implemented readily, and that we're actually working on it. But motivation for it is if you look at the Kondo effect, it's an example of another many body effect where you have many free electrons. They're not interacting with each other, but they all interact with a single spin 1/2 kind of impurity, partly because the density of states is high at the Fermi energy and at the Fermi sphere, you get this very strong enhancement of interaction. In fact, electrons begin to interact with each other very efficiently, such that, if you measure resistance of a metal film with with a tiny impurities content, you still get kind of a huge effect. And you can think of this Kondo effect as an example of a quantum impurity problem where you have many modes which don't interact with each other, that are coupled to one single quantum system, like a qubit or spin. And if this coupling is arranged to be strong enough, you're getting a strongly interacting many-body system that many theories studied and developed methods to solve it. So it seems like an interesting thing to try to simulate. So our approach to this problem is to start with I need some modes and I need some quantum system that these modes will talk to. So in superconducting systems you get modes from a transmission line. So you just have two wires, you have some electric and magnetic fields traveling back and forth with the speed of light, and so these are your modes. In practice it's going to look like this. You're going to have some kind of let's come back to the circuit's representation. So we're going to have some chain of inductors and capacitors that's going to form a transmission line. this transmission line will be characterized by, you know, velocity, which is given by this square root of sort of inductance and capacitance per unit length, and impedance, which is another combination of L and C. So these are the only two sort of materials parameters of this transmission line. And the classical variables of this transmission line is just the density, sort of the charge on this capacitor, and its conjugate one that would be flux in the inductors. Now, if you just write the Hamiltonian of this using fancy notations, it's going to remind to some of you a Latin derivative. Okay, you have the energy associated, you know, you have this quadratic and density term, which is the capacitive energy, and then the gradient term quadratic, which is the inductive energy. And okay, so you have, and you have this interaction parameter G, which is actually related to this impedance. And so to make it dimensionless, you need to divide it by this RQ, which is the impedance quantum for Cooper pairs. And so this ratio is determining, you know, essentially the properties of this Latendre liquid. Of course, it's very simple. Look, if you take a translationally invariant one-dimensional electrons, it's not a particularly exciting system because it's described just by this non-interacting waves. So what makes it interesting is if you introduce an impurity. And in case of let's say a Latendre liquid, usually it's always been, you know, if you try to tunnel into it, or if you try to break the 1D wire into two pieces and consider some weak coupling between the two, that's where we begin to get some action.
Yeah. Could you go back one slide?
Yeah.
So.
Not here. So yeah.
As soon as G is unequal to 1,
yeah,
people would naively say the system is already interacting in some form. So some source of interactions, unless it's backscattering, would just be absorbed by varying the value of G.
Well,
so are you saying that in some way forward scattering is just already included by parametrizing G and RQ, basically?
It's just, if you just have that, look, it's just Maxwell's equation. So you just have waves. So in order to talk about the forward or backward scattering, you need to actually introduce scattering terms. And if you have an electronic system, typically scattering is what's always present there. So because, you know, you always have some contact through which you tunnel, you know, in order to pass current, then you always think that, okay, scattering is always there. So then this G value is very important. But if scattering is not there, if it's just a translation invariant system, then you would never find out that there is interaction.
So what's quantum about this circuit? What's quantum about this?
Nothing. That's the point. Nothing.
And so these phis and rho are fields, or?
Well, they could be, but in a linear system, it doesn't matter, right? So they could be fields, or they could be classical fields or quantum fields. But as long as you only have a translationally invariant transmission line, you will never find out. But in order to find out, you need to introduce an impurity. And we're going to exactly introduce this backscattering impurity. And it turns out that if you just insert a Josephson junction in the middle of this transmission line, you see it's going to have this energy which is given by sort of, you know, the sort of the flux at this spot and the flux at this spot, the difference. And that mathematically is identical to exactly the backscattering impurity in a Latendre liquid, where now all of a sudden this G parameter becomes the real thing, and depending on the value of the G, the transmission properties would be drastically different. So the magic is that the Josephson effect is exactly mapped onto a backscattering in the electronic picture. So when a Cooper pair tunnels, it creates some kind of a plasmon, you know, it creates a voltage spike that, you know, that launches a plasmon, and you know, if you, you know, convert it back to electronic picture, it looks as if you have interacting electrons backscattered.
So Vlad, I'm a bit confused with this left and right and phi and rho. So typically in a spinless electrons that in the liquid, you have phi L and phi R, and you construct out of them phi and theta, or phi.
Right.
Now you have phi L, phi R, then also row L and row R?
Yes, you do. Yeah, I
the mapping is to a two-channel Latin liquid.
Yeah, I didn't add the raw term. A raw term is kind of is needed. I think I will have it on another slide. This was meant to
but we should think of it as a semi-infinite Latin J liquid.
Yeah, exactly.
And it has two channels, right? It seems that you by the picture, it seems that you fold the whole thing.
I think you fold. That's how I think about it. Because when I show a real device, it will actually be folded. So this is just to make it me. You see, I deliberately made it as a sketch just to transmit an idea first, and then I'll show you an exact setting.
Sure. So you said that it doesn't matter if it's quantum or classical. So are you saying that if you take this chain of this inductance, the capacitance will actually show correlation functions of electrons purely liquid? Like purely classical.
If you'll find a way to measure that correlation function, then yes. But the whole point is that in order to do this, you will have to introduce the impurity.
Because to have an e to the I phi, you need an impurity. Otherwise,
yeah.
The only thing you have are like
phi and rho, yeah.
Like two fermion operators.
So the impurity here is pretty strong perturbation, right? So you can imagine just coupling out your electromagnetic wave from two places of your wave guide, right? And so doing some sort of perturbative measurements, I don't know, some EE correlator.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, you don't necessarily need this. You need some sort of probe.
So when you couple to an electromagnetic line, you typically couple to phi and to rho. Linearly, but in order to measure, an interesting correlation function is like Arkady says, it's e to the I phi, and that one is the Josephson effect. So in electronics picture, you see Latinger liquid only when you tunnel electrons into it. So when you measure conductance, but if you don't have an option to measure the conductance in a 1D channel, like what do you measure? Okay, so now this problem actually is known in another completely different field. Is if you study superconducting insulated transition, this problem is just maps onto this Schmidt-Bulgodiev transition when you insert a junction into sort of a transmission line with many modes. And so from the point of view of this junction, the transmission line just looks like a resistor. And the quantum fluctuations in these modes, they shake the phase. And they shake it such that, you know, sine phi can be zero or non-zero in the quantum ground state. And it turns out that there's a transition that happens approximately where this ratio of the impedance to resistance quantum is like one half. And so essentially when the impedance of the transmission line is high, the phase is shaken so much that there's actually a quantum phase transition and sine phi average is zero, so there's no supercurrent. Or in other words, the Josephson energy got renormalized to zero. Well, when the impedance is low compared to quantum, then sine phi is still non-zero, and you get a superconducting state, meaning that Cooper pairs can still go through. So that's sort of a different community's view of this system. But the mathematics is exactly the same.
So basically, you're saying it's the SARS CJ. So there was an experiment, right? And why would like how do I think I got the transition between the old state? So your story is different.
Well, the story is that there are tons of scenarios by which a junction will show sort of a crossover from a superconducting to insulating behavior. Here, the point is that you don't want to see that. Here you want to measure correlation functions of this system in an experiment. So when you show that your resistance goes to infinity, you measure no correlation functions at all. You just say, look, it seems that there is some similarity between this model and what happens in the experiment. So this is kind of we're really trying to build a true quantum simulator so that we could literally take two different approaches to calculate this correlation function and actually compare and figure out which one is correct. That's it. And actually, this transition has never really been truly observed. And part of the problem is that when you try to measure conductance, you always drive the system out of equilibrium. and so essentially this theory is no longer really valid. So this is why you see some evidence that you were superconducting, now you're insulating, but exactly what happened still remains unclear. And so the point here is that, okay, so how are we going to probe this physics? Well, I have a transmission line, you have an impurity, so let's just scatter microwaves and measure their transmission spectrum, and we got to be able to somehow see what's going on through the transmission spectrum. So you see, it's a very different experiment than measuring resistance in a real circuit. And just to be more specific now, so this is a setup. So you take a transmission line. It has a finite size L. It has the impedance Z and velocity V. So that's its Hamiltonian. And then you couple to one side a port through which you can send a microwave in and see what comes back. And you can actually send, let's say, a signal at one frequency, what comes back at the other frequency. And then you're going to couple the impurity, which is going to be looking like this. It's going to be sort of a squid of the two junctions, so that by applying some flux, you can tune it, the value. And you see, it's in one end, so it's like a single, like semi-infinite system. Of course, it's actually finite because it will have a finite length in the experiment. And in fact, we can vary this length, and that would be one of the parameters we change in the experiment. And so the coupling will be like this. So you will have this phi term that couples to this backscattering, and you're going to have the quadratic rho term, which I think is not very important. So Adi, is this two channel or one?
No, it's one channel. Yeah. So I guess you don't have phi L and phi R, right? Yeah. You have just phi. At any point, you have just one phi.
Yeah, I think it was a bad labeling on my end. I just meant phi L is phi sort of to the left of the impurity, and phi R is to the right. I mean, it's just
but
like...
You don't have to do it.
Yeah.
You have nothing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a single channel.
All right, so how does this transmission line relate to this initial picture of self-repeating elements? What was the purpose of introducing and analyzing?
Oh, I'll show you, because that's how we build it, because we don't have this. We have to build it out of elements. So to give you some idea of what are the quantities that we're interested in this model, is what you can do is you can now ask the question, well, if I send this plasmon at a frequency omega, if the system is completely non-dissipative and if there are no inelastic processes, it should just come back. Maybe with a different phase, but it should come back. However, the impurity is superconducting, the transmission line is superconducting, so there should be no options for this photon to be lost. However, the main prediction of this model is that because of the strong interaction and renormalization effects, photons at one frequency get scattered into photons at all other frequencies. And so if you calculate the total elastic reflection amplitude, that's this blue curve. So this is the reflection, and this is the frequency. And so you see that it's never unity. It has some shape that says that if you send a photon at one frequency, it doesn't come back to you. And in fact, if you send it, at this frequency that is given by some specific scale, which will happen to be related to quantum temperature, you get maximal loss of photons. And it looks as if your system is just dissipative. However, if you now do inelastic scattering experiments, where you, let's say, send photon at some frequency, like in this slide, and look what comes back at a different frequency, that's the spectrum that you're going to measure. And so this spectrum was calculated using, it was calculated actually by my close collaborator on this experiment, Moshe Goldstein from University of Tel Aviv. And in fact, it's not published yet. We've been just exchanging some initial results. But the point is that, that is what we measure.
So again, this is, you send with a frequency omega?
So the blue one, you send with a frequency omega, and you see what comes back at the frequency omega.
And the black one?
And the black one, you send at the frequency, at the frequency of, if I'm not mistaken, some like 5 omega or something like this. I think it looks like 5 because it's, you know, it's 0 here. And you look at what comes back at all other frequencies. And then you see that, oh, actually there's this very broad...
the frequency you send in is 5 on this plot?
Yeah, I think it's 5, but I wouldn't... It's a big one. It's not like 1/2 or it's like a few times omega.
But then there should be some sort of a sum rule, no?
Yes.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
In this theory one, there's definitely conservation of energy. So, but it's the way the energy gets redistributed is essentially it's telling you about the many body effect. So that's really the main idea. And this was something that I think Moshe came up with working with Leonid Glazman. There's actually only one paper on this subject because you know people thought it would be pretty hard to measure, but I think we're close. Yeah.
What's the nonlinear optics analog in this measurement?
None. Because you see, you get such a strong coupling of modes to the scatterer that if you look, you see, if you think of your scatterer as an atom with some, like a hydrogen atom with some transition, these plasmons must broaden it by an amount comparable to the transition. And that would roughly be where you get close to the phase transition. And so so you see in quantum optics, it's just impossible. In circuits, it's easy.
Asking your question again, I thought the quantum optics analog was replacing the cosine by a quadratic and a quartic term. And that would be, say, parametric
Dampen. Yeah, I was just questioning whether this is analogous to
permit. Oh, no, it's not. Sorry. That's a good question. Let me explain why. So in typical down and up conversion experiments, you usually send, let's say, one photon, really a truly one quantum of energy in one mode, and then you have to drive the whole media with, you know, 10,000 photons to pump it, and then you're going to get photons appearing sort of at the sum and the difference frequencies. Here, you don't pump this system. You just literally send one photon in one mode, and you just see, you will see that, you know, it's going to come up, you know, at a different, you know, this certain probability is going to come up at different frequencies. So, and I think it splits in sort of two photon processes. That would be the dominant one.
Where's the many body physics here? So you don't have like a temperature, there is no ground state or anything, it's basically just scattering problem, right, of sorts.
It is, yeah, but the many body effects make your scattering inelastic and broad in energy.
Is there a notion of quantum temperature here?
Yeah, so this peak happens, you see this omega P renormalized is basically the quantum temperature. Yeah.
Are the energy scales such that you could actually just heat up the cavity and look at just the output port and actually use that to measure thermal quanta?
Maybe I can tell you the numbers, and maybe you can tell me what you have in mind. The idea here was to operate in a situation where temperature is smaller than the frequency in this plot, so that we could just do a zero temperature dynamics first. But we can certainly heat it up and make temperature comparable to quantum temperature. But we thought it's probably not the most interesting thing to do first.
So it's the Josephson scale. What is the Josephson scale?
The Josephson scale. Well, there's no Josephson scale. Yeah. Well, it starts sort of higher than one, and then it's renormalized.
So it's on the scale of those graphs. Mm-hmm. So where's the Josephson energy?
There is none. Well, it's the ratio of frequency to the this effective quantum temperature.
So what is Josephson energy compared to your omega p?
To what? Oh, to omega p. Sorry. In this calculation, it's probably factor of u. So it's basically, the Josephson energy was a few times bigger than this omega p. Sorry, I now understand the question.
So then, since you're saying everything is so nonlinear, what prevents up conversion? Why are you saying we're saying conversion?
Well, to up convert, you need energy, right? So you send one photon.
You have a CW, right?
No. I think this was calculated assuming that you just kind of send one photon at a time, so that we don't really have two photons in a mode at any time.
But it depends, like, any problem the photon dwells, right, in your system. I think because you have some stuff happening, obviously.
Well, in this setup, it's just, there's no dwell time, right? I mean, just kind of travels through. Look, I don't know. That's what I calculated. I didn't calculate it. I measured it.
So that's in the paper, or?
It is in the paper. Yeah, it is in the paper. Yeah, you can not this plot. They calculated it for a different setup, but it essentially looks very similar.
If it's pure latent radius vectors.
So I'm asking you the question: is there this figure? There's nothing on larger than 5.
Yeah, well, because I think the way it was calculated is that the incoming photon frequency was 5, and you don't get anything bigger than. I mean, it makes sense to me, right? Because you don't have any energy, extra energy. You send a 5 omega photon, it can only scatter into less than 5 omega photons.
So you can take 2 photons and then they distribute.
But I think you do it in the condition, because it's a strongly nonlinear system, so really it's important how many photons you send at a time, and so here you just send 1.
So this is kind of like a cascade where you send 1 photon and
I think so, yeah. But like if you would especially put some mirror at some, like if you put a mirror here, then they could come back and scatter again and again. So it's a pretty unusual situation, I think, for typical quantum optics scenario, which is entirely due to the many upper body aspects of this problem.
But this cascade thing, couldn't one check whether there's different pulses coming back at different times? So supposedly, probably the mode velocity also depends on the energy. And you could probably see some.
As an experimenter, I can tell you what's going to happen. We didn't get to there yet, but essentially you do indeed a CW experiment, because that's the easiest one. And then you just observe the spectrum, and you would see that when the power of this incoming signal is low, and you vary the power, nothing happens. You just measure some distribution. But then, as soon as you increase power above certain sort of, you know, some value, you're going to begin to see that this curve begins to depend on the incoming power. And I think these are all the effects you guys are talking about.
Sorry, I get confused more and more. You say you cannot have energy gain in your system. But at the same token, you can't have energy loss, right?
Yeah.
And so there must be photons with higher frequency, right?
No, you do loss. So loss appears as a redistribution of photons at different energies. That's.
But you're not also assuming that the qubit is, nonlinear element is cooling down as you do the experiment, particularly in a low power regime. Because I think this is calculated, assuming that starts in its ground state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a place where energy can go. And then it cools down to the environment you don't have.
So in the experiment, the energy just leaves through the same port it entered. It's just that what happens is that you send energy at one frequency. It gets redistributed here over all other frequencies. And then every frequency has some decay rate because it's coupled to the outside. That's it.
Where should more energy come from if you have a decay of a certain incoming excitation and some energy?
I'm a quantum optics more like Michael. Yes, I said I can take 2 photons of one frequency, one can go to a lower and one can go to a higher.
There's just one photon.
No, this is nonlinear, right? This is all nonlinear.
Yeah, it's not just Duncan where it's optimized. I mean, it's nonlinear. It would say
that photon.
So it should tell me what intensity is. I should know what the intensities of the incoming laser are. So you're saying the signal is
very weak.
That's what I'm saying. It's very weak. It's in the limit where quantum optics never do the experiments because they will see nothing. So that's the whole point. You're in the limit where a single photon can begin down converting itself. It's very unusual. And look, we still yet to find out what's going to happen, but that's the idea. I'm glad you find it, confusing. That was the point. It's different from down conversion.
The G that this is calculated for, what does it correspond to in electronic terms? Repulsive.
So this transition is where you go. You begin to be repulsive.
So G C equals 1 is non-interacting.
So what happens in the electronic one, if I understand correctly, is that when you're attracting, the perturbation is the scattering is irrelevant and kind of nothing happens. But then when it becomes repulsive, even weakly, you get this strong effect. Mm-hmm. And so this point where you switch sign is exactly where GC is 1.
Is it this Toulouse point or something?
That one is somewhere close. I mean, in this language, it's like G being either 1 or 1/2. I don't remember. But the point is that G has to be big, and that actually brings me. Let me move on a little bit. That brings me to another point I wanted to make is that okay, so how do you make G of order unity? Because actually, it was really the, I would say, 90% of the experimental effort here. And as Adi says, you know, you really want to be close to that G equals to 1, because essentially if you're attracting, then it's just not interesting. So you have to be kind of close to the transition to repulsive, and that's where and that's exactly where G is 1. And just to explain what it means in circuits language is that the impedance has to be of order resistance quantum. And so if you take an LC circuit, just a single mode, you know, you have charge and flux, and you look at the wave function of, the function of flux, it will have certain widths, and this width is essentially given by this G. And so when G is big, it means that the flux wave function is broad, and when G is small, it's when the flux wave function is narrow. And so you see, if you have a cos phi perturbation and flux is narrow, you can expand cos phi to, you know, the fourth order term, and none of this interesting stuff will happen. While if flux fluctuates by a lot, then you have to use cosine, and then when this stuff happens. And so you basically need high impedance to for the cos to stay cos and not just just a Kerr effect. And so going back to your question, why are we not why are we doing it out of elements? Because if you just take a regular like a transmission line that is used, you know, to carry, let's say, your TV signal, then you see L and C scale in the same way, and in fact L is proportional to permeability of free space and C is proportional to permittivity of free space. So if you divide, you're going to get a fundamental constant of nature, which is the vacuum impedance, and it's much smaller than the impedance quantum. So you're always going to be in the attractive Latendre liquid regime, which is not what we want to do. We want to go repulsive, so we need to bring the impedance high.
It's a fundamental constant is between 50 and 377.
That's because you're limited in, let's say, what kind of substrates you can use to fabricate your transmission line, and you know, silicon has a dielectric constant of not 1 but 10, and that what brings it down, and things like that. So, but it's still pretty fun. You know, it's varying on the scale of ohms, but compared to RQ, it's still fundamentally small. That's really the point. If you deal with sort of 3D waves, it's usually around 377 ohms. If you deal with your TV cable, it's typically 50 ohms. So it's still pretty fundamental, although not a meteorological, you know, constant.
So for grants, yeah. There's some log, right, of the ratio of diameters?
Yeah, which basically doesn't do anything.
So if you're, so how big of a cable would you need to?
It has to be of the size of the universe. Yes. Sorry. That's the property of a log function. So this is our solution. And by the way, I don't know, Dima, how much time do I have left?
15 minutes total.
Okay. Good. So anyway, so now I think I've communicated at least the basic idea. Now I'm going to be telling you how we've made it and what's our progress. And okay, so if I'm out of time, then it's not a big deal. We can discuss later. But so the idea is that we're going to make a transmission line out of a chain of Josephson junctions. So just a few slides ago, Josephson junction was an impurity. Now all of a sudden, Josephson junctions are everywhere. But that's pretty standard in our field. Junctions have different flavor, and depending on their flavor, they could be, they could do completely different roles in an experiment. And so here the idea is that you make this a chain like this. So you take a junction, which is usually usually represented the capacitor and the Josephson element, and there is some ground capacitance, and that's an actual device.
What about disorder?
We'll get to that. But before we get to that, I need to teach you just a little bit about what these junctions are. Okay? And so this is my crash course. So the junction, Okay, there are tons of ways of making them, but there's only one that works, and there's only one that people use, so I'm just going to focus on that. If you make an overlap of two aluminum film, it has to be aluminum. And there's an aluminum oxide, you know, on this film before this one gets deposited. So you get a sandwich, you know, can be represented like this. So there's a tunneling barrier, and that's the junction. And junction has two electromagnetic properties, and most obvious one is it's actually a capacitor because you get some electric field in this oxide, which, you know, it's always there, and it's fundamentally important that all this stuff works. And then there's this Josephson inductance, where, you know, it just explains, you know, corresponds to Cooper pairs tunneling. So if you ignore, you know, the sinusoidal or cosinusoidal potential energy of this cross, you can linearize it, and then it means that if you let phase B, it's going to vibrate back and forth, and this capacitance plays the role of a mass, and the Josephson effect plays the role of a spring constant, and so there will be this characteristic vibration frequency, which is called plasma frequency, and because capacitance scales with the area and inductance scales inversely with the area, the product, the frequency, is actually also a fundamental constant of nature, and is between 20 and 30 gigahertz. And if you work really hard, you can make it 40 or 15, but that's really the scale. And this is the fundamental energy scale in our problem. So we're gonna, let's say, map it to, you know, like to quantum physics. This is the bandwidth. So all our energy has to be confined to that. And the second phenomena here is that if you actually calculate the inductance of this junction, and let's say you divide it by some length scale, which I usually use as a square root of the area, you're going to find that it's about 10 to the 4 times bigger than an inductance of a wire of a comparable size. And that's more or less what makes G from, you know, approximately 1%, you know, to 1, because G scales the square root of that. So one more thing I have to tell about junctions is that there are large and small junctions. Again, it's a highly colloquial notations, but it works really well. So a large junction is a situation where you have a big Josephson energy and a big capacitor. So that big capacitor means that the mass is heavy. So you have a lot of levels, and you vibrate just at the bottom of one Josephson well, and you never find out that you can actually tunnel to the other one. And in that case, cosine is indeed just kind of a, you know, a quartically nonlinear object. And you can use this large junction just as an inductance, maybe with just a little bit of nonlinearity. The tunneling amplitude actually goes exponential with this ratio of ADJ over EC. And we typically define this number of levels in the well, which is given by square root of EJ over EC. And basically, when you have a lot more than one, we call it large. And when you have about one, we call it small. And because of the exponential scaling, the transition is very sharp. So you can use it as a formal definition. And so the point here is that we're going to use big junctions to make a transmission line, and we're going to small junctions to make an impurity. This is a side note for those who know a bit more about these circuits than this, is that you can always turn small into large by shunting a junction with a big capacitor, because, you know, EJ stays the same, but the charging energy drops. But reverse doesn't work. So large cannot be made small, but small can be made large. Okay, so now I'm going to show you some actual devices. So this is how you make this chain of junctions. You know, the sketch looks like this again. So you have a set of ions at the bottom, and then they're oxidized, so green is the oxide. Then you get a set of ions at the top, so that the current kind of flows sort of up and down, up and down, up and down through this chain. This is how it looks, you know, when you look with a scanning tunneling microscope. And this is the simplest device you can make. It's a pretty short transmission line, and it's coupled to some antennas so that you can, which represent the port. And so what we can do is we can send some waves in. They're going to couple through this antenna to these junctions, you know, interact and scatter back. And so if we make it short, we're going to get only one resonance, if you want, only one, you know, mode, one standing wave. And what we measure, so this is important. So you measure some reflection. In this case, it's a transmission. So you send waves sort of through this device, and when you don't hit the resonance, wave just go through. So the amplitude of the transmission and phase doesn't change with frequency. But when you hit the resonance, the thing begins to scatter, and so you get some shape that you can fit perfectly to some, you know, simple you know, scattering, you know, linear scattering theory expression, and you can extract. this important quantity, so the three things you can extract. You can extract the frequency, of course, and you can extract the rates at which energy dies inside the device and rate at which the energy leaves back to your port. And these are really the three quantities that we're measuring, and we extract everything we need from that.
Again, why do we need large junctions for a transmission level?
Because you see, we want to make a very large impedance.
Can you show this small cosine wave?
Yeah. This one? Yeah.
So in this case, I guess you get some sort of bulk sine Gordon equation, right? That can transmit modes. They are not extended modes, but it's an integrable model, so you can transmit
you can,
a solid mode, and it's a transmission line too, right?
Yeah, you can.
Why do we need Luttinger amplitude?
Well, we can study that model too. It's just that we chose to study an impurity model rather than the bulk sine Gordon one, and there are reasons for that. I don't want to explain why. You'll run into troubles if you want to actually study a bulk sine Gordon. And that's exactly why we do large junctions, because we don't want to have any large.
I mean, if you don't want the sine Gordon.
Yeah, we want large junctions to have an absolutely linear transmission line, and then all the effects are caused by the small impurity junction. And we have to use junctions to get the impedance high. And by the way, even though we try to make the nonlinearity weak by using large junction, it's still there. And so the way you see this is that, so this is the same transmission experiment where you increase the power. So the red is the lowest power and blue is the higher power. And so what happens is that your transmission at some point begins to switch. And this is a nonlinear effect, pretty well understood. I'm not going to go into details of this. It's described in Landau and Lifshitz Volume 1 called Nonlinear Resonance. But what it tells us is that there's a quartic nonlinearity exactly left from that cosine, expansion to the fourth order, and we understand it pretty well. And the point is that don't drive the system too hard. So if you don't want to use study that nonlinearity, and then we go to the main device, which is this very long transmission line, just so that you realize how big it is. There are 35,000 junctions. And each junction, if you just take by itself, is going to be a typical transmon superconducting qubit. So you have 35,000 qubits here. That's how it looks. So junction, 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 junction. It's 10 millimeters long and it's 10 micron kind of across. And each junction minimal size is about 200 nanometers. So the aspect ratios here are kind of enormous, but it still works. And this is the spectrum of plasmons that you expect from this line. So you see you have this kind of an optical mode, which is just a resonance in each junction. It's called plasma resonance. And then you're going to get this kind of acoustic branch, which is just the standing waves, and they have to kind of merge. And then if you now quantize the K vector, you're going to see that your modes begin to bunch up towards the band edge, and that's sort of the system. So you see the system has some dispersion. So it's not a non-dispersive transmission line, but it is dispersive at low at small K vectors.
Is it theoretical?
This is theoretical. This is experimental. So what you do in an experiment, so now you do the same transmission, and now instead of one peak that was a couple of slides ago, you see a lot of them. So it's a very broad band range. You see about 4 to 15, and 15 is it's close to the highest frequency we can measure at close to the bandwidth. And the point is that, there are a lot of features. Some of them are irrelevant, just kind of calibration issues. But you see this forest of peaks, which kind of persist everywhere. So here the peaks are smaller, but they're there. You can zoom in, you're going to see that there's some kind of almost uniform level spacing. And then this is the spacing around 5 gigahertz, this is the spacing around 10 gigahertz, so it changes a little bit. And then we can extract, now we can do this kind of procedure to extract the quality factors and the frequency. And we can plot, and now the black dots is the experiment, and the red line is that theory from the previous graph. And so you see that's the dispersion. So we see about 150 modes. And that's the frequency, and somewhere up there will be a plasma mode that makes this thing bend. If we, when we fit this, we can extract the parameters, And let me just discuss them, because that's really the main result, you know, so far that we have in this project, is that the plasma mode is at about 22 gigahertz, which is, you know, typical as this, you know, it's a fundamental constant of nature. The speed of light here, the slope, is about 100 times slower than the real speed of light, and is completely broadband, so it's really a metamaterial where light is 100 times slower at all frequencies of its existence. And the impedance is about 1.3 times the impedance quantum, so it's about like 7 or 8 kilo ohms, and it exceeds that critical value for the Luttinger liquid model by a factor of I think about 4, so it's way in this repulsive regime. So in principle, we can reduce it to it's easy. It's hard to increase it above that, but it's easy to reduce it to the transition point. Okay, so density of states is approximately at level spacing is 100 megahertz, could be made smaller, and pretty small losses.
What about disorder?
Hold on to that thought. Okay, so there's even a more challenging question. You can say, well, wait a second. You're saying that you have a transmission line with a superconducting transmission line with an impedance of bigger than resistance quantum. These people say that Bradley and Doniak said in 84 it shouldn't exist. You should have a superconducting insulated transition exactly around that point, just because each junction feels the environment of the others in the transmission line, and you should just get an insulated transition. So what they didn't take into account is that you have two capacitors and not one. And so this capacitor, this junction capacitor that creates dispersion, actually does something else. It decouples the quantum fluctuations generated by the plasmons from each junction at high frequencies, so that the junction stays in the superconducting regime, while at low frequencies impedance can still be high. And the second thing that helps us is that it's very hard to have a phase slip in individual junction because, so Larkin and Glassman say that when your array becomes infinitely long, you should get a gain insulated transition. But this thing is finite, and kind of the problems scale linearly with number of junctions, while we can suppress them exponentially with the junction size. And so that's really the trick. So, and that answers the question that yes, you can have a pretty long transmission line with an impedance higher than 50 ohm that is still superconducting. And now, what about the disorder? So, well, if you look at the plot, you see that there's a hole here, and there are no points above mode about 150.
So, the upper low is just you don't have the ability to measure it?
Here?
Yeah.
No, that's where the lowest mode is. Okay, maybe a few points. No, we measured all the modes. Maybe they were not put on this graph. No, we could measure all the modes down there, but we see like 3 or 4 modes missing here, and no modes above about like 13 gigahertz. If you look now at the, if you zoom in on this plot, if you look at the difference between theory and experiment, you're going to see a spread in frequencies that, you know, they're actually not exactly equally spaced. And that's Anton is the disorder. And so there was this recently a calculation of exactly our system by Skoy and Hicking, whose statement was this. So because it's a bosonic system, you're going to get localization, but your localization length will be frequency dependent. So at low frequencies, you cannot localize these plasmons because, you know, a zero frequency plasmon is just a supercurrent that flows through the entire thing, and of course it will not care about disorder. But while at high frequencies, yes, you're going to get, you know, the same kind of localization that you have in mind for electrons. And it looks like what's happening, we still need to find this out. So, for instance, you see that the spread is increasing towards higher frequencies. It's vaguely consistent with.
What's the vertical axis?
It's the mode number. It's
no,
the
vertical axis.
Oh, vertical. It's the difference between theory and experiment.
Theory.
So you see the red is a dispersion of a homogeneous line, and black are the frequency points measured in the experiment. And so you see on this scale, it looks like it fits perfectly, but if you look at the difference, you're going to see this.
So maybe you're going to tell us about it, but is it obvious that everything has to be positive?
Sorry?
The value is positive, like 20. Is that meaningful?
Oh, sorry. So there is some systematic thing that I'm going to ask you to ignore. So what I'm basically asking you to look at is sort of the spread locally. Okay, so ignore this average trend. It's just some technical issue that we're fixing. But the point is that you see the spread actually changes with frequency.
That's the Q, right, of 10 to the 4?
No, it has nothing to do with the Q, no. The Q is a lot, the line width of this resonance is a lot smaller than the spread. So this is really the frequencies are off. And we believe this is due to disorder, but we still need to find out. The evidence that there is some localization physics is that you see the prediction is that the high frequency modes will be localized while the low frequency mode will be extended, and there will be some localization length that depends on the homogeneities of the junctions, and as long as it's smaller than the at frequencies where localization length is higher than the system size, your modes are propagating, and we see a lot of them. But then when the localization lengths become smaller than the system size, you just can no longer couple them to your antennas. You just don't see them. And we believe that this is what's happening, but this is a pretty fresh experiment. It's only like 3 weeks old. We still need to, you know.
But can this explain the missing of some selected modes in the middle? Because following your argument, you should see some... Like,
There are some predictions that you can get actually missing modes, but of course they should not be missing from the low end. But this is sort of close it's close to the high end. So we still need to find out. We just need to make devices of different lengths and see what happens. But that's the evidence of the disorder. But at least if you look at the low energies, it's pretty good. And it's really the low energies that dominate this renormalization physics. So it actually looks awesome because all these effects of dispersion are effectively canceled by frequency-dependent localization. So dispersion helps you not to go to undergo insulated transition, and then localization actually prevents these modes from interfering in your scattering experiment. So it's like a lemonade. And the final data remark is that if you now drive these modes at a higher power, there's still no intentional impurity. The line as homogeneous as we could make, it's still nonlinear. So the red response is a low power one, and the blue one is a high power one. There is a switching, and we can have this kind of switching phase diagram that we can perfectly fit to this quartic nonlinear model. So it seems that you get this leftover nonlinearity from big junctions, and it's still there. And if you like it, we can access it by driving it at higher powers. So far everything seems to make sense. And so now I'm going to conclude. You can also do Kondo impurity by just modifying your impurity. You have to make either a charge qubit or a flux qubit. You can tune the impedance by making it as an array of squids, and you can actually tune your G. What's really awesome is that we can, on a very fast time scale, we can change things like infrared cutoff just by, we can change impedance twice by pulsing the flux, and that would change the speed of light, so it will change the level spacing. And presumably, if you're in a strong coupling regime, changing level spacing by a factor of 2 should give a big effect. We can do things like in Kondo, impedance is equivalent to exchange anisotropy, so we can actually go from anisotropic to isotropic model. We can also apply very fast, effective magnetic fields to the impurity to kind of create a big Zeeman field on and off, and study time domain dynamics of these things, which is really, I think, the most exciting in this project. Okay, so I'm going to conclude now. I think I'm out of time. There are other motivations that I like this system. You can do block oscillations. You can make better qubits. But anyway, thank you for your attention.